Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet the University of Tulsa's Phi Beta Kappa visiting scholar. Dr. Michael Deem of Rice University is the John W. Cox Professor of Biochemical and Genetic Engineering. He also teaches in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the university. He's a physicist and biochemist working in the areas of evolution, immunology, and materials. And he's developed methods to quantify vaccine effectiveness for influenza. He's also designed a physical theory of the competition that allows HIV to escape from the immune system, and the first exact solution of a mathematical model of evolution that accounts for cross-species genetic exchange. The research has led to more than a dozen patents and a number of awards, including the National Science Foundation's Career Award, and he was named one of the top 100 young innovators. Currently, he's working on ways to create a vaccine for the four types of the tropical disease dengue fever. Professor Deem will be lecturing on In Search of Fundamental Mathematical Laws of Biology this afternoon at 4 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the University of Tulsa campus, and that lecture is free and open to the public. Michael Deem is my guest today. Michael Deem, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning.
You're going to be speaking on finding fundamental mathematical laws of biology. Now, we think of math and biology really not going well together, but this seems like this is a new evolving area of research of, I assume it's sort of like physicists looking for a grand unified theory, some relationship between biology and maybe mathematical laws or equations or principles that make sense every time, like in physics.
I was fortunate to be part of a new DARPA program to find fundamental mathematical laws in biology. And there was a lot of effort on behalf of about 10 mathematicians and 10 biologists to see if there are some of these unifying themes that we can express mathematically. And since then, many physicists have begun to look into biology, especially the large data collection efforts in biology. Can we try to understand and organize and really extrapolate those data using mathematical principles? Yes.
Can you give us an area where we're seeing some parts of the natural world and biology where mathematical principles fit in?
There's something called systems biology, which is the study of how proteins and genes interact to form networks. And many physicists have developed this area, and quite a bit of the analysis of the data is mathematical. So that's a nice new area for students to do research in, where mathematics plays some role in developing biology.
Mm-hmm. This project's been going on for a few years. What are you learning through the course of the research?
So one of the areas I've been interested in is how structure develops in biology. How does biology sort of emerge out of chemistry, for example? And some of the principles are that if the environment is changing, then the biological system will become more adaptable. And this is one of the driving forces for the development of modularity and structure in biology.
Modularity and structure. You're going to have to explain that for us.
So biology has units. A protein is made up of atoms. The atoms make up amino acids. The amino acids make up secondary structures.
Well, I want to change the focus for a moment. I know one of the active areas of research which we can relate to oftentimes it has to do with your work in influenza viruses. You've been working with influenza viruses for a while. How did that get started?
I was getting a flu shot at Costco from a nurse, and she told me some aspects of the flu shot that were interesting to me. So we thought about that for a while.
What did she say that was interesting to
you? Well, she said it's possible under some conditions that if you get a flu shot in 1 year and not the next year, that flu shot might not protect you the next year and might even maybe make you more susceptible to the flu the next year. That's kind of controversial. Not everyone believes that. But we were interested in that. So now what we've developed is a theory of efficacy of a vaccine. So if a person's vaccinated against one strain of the virus and then sees a slightly different strain of the virus, how useful will that vaccine be?
And how effective is a vaccine when they see a different strain?
Right. So by quantifying how different the strain is in the virus versus the vaccine, we can say, will the vaccine be effective or not? And in some units, if the distance between the vaccine and the virus is greater than a certain critical value, the vaccine will no longer be effective. So the idea is, knowing that information, can that help us pick the strains of the vaccine so that the vaccine is as close as possible to the viruses?
Now, to get back to what that nurse said, this is if you don't get the vaccine 1 year and you're vaccinated against another strain of the influenza virus, is there any truth to the fact that it might raise your susceptibility to getting influenza?
Sure. I try not to focus on that now. There are some data that suggest this is the case. So this is one of the reasons that it's recommended for people who are susceptible to the flu that they get the vaccine every year.
Now, one of the things you've been studying is how influenza evolves so rapidly. What is it about the influenza virus that makes it so easily adaptable?
Influenza is what's known as an RNA virus, and this means that it has a fairly high rate of evolution. The mutations occur quite commonly in the flu virus, and the flu virus has, in fact, organized itself so that when the immune system recognizes it, the flu virus can mutate to try to escape from the immune system. And this happens such that the virus will sort of evade the typical vaccine in 2 to 3 years. So this is why the vaccines for the flu need to be redesigned every year, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Is that because it's an RNA virus?
The RNA virus allows the system to mutate very quickly. And then secondly, the flu has a protein called hemagglutinin on its surface, which your immune system recognizes. But the flu was sort of very clever. That hemagglutinin can be changed fairly easily by the virus, and it doesn't disrupt the function of the virus, but it does allow the virus to escape from your antibodies.
Give us a sense of the research you're doing in vaccine efficacy. You mentioned that, again, this is a mathematical model of seeing how far the flu strain that is out there is from the vaccine design. Give us a sense of how that research is coming along.
Sure. So traditionally, people have estimated how effective the vaccine will be by doing animal model studies. Ferrets are the standard model for the flu. And it turns out that ferrets are not a perfect model of humans, of course. And our theory has a greater ability to predict what the vaccine will do in humans than the ferrets can, for example. So the theory, this is perhaps a somewhat unusual case, the theory is more predictive than the animal model studies. So we can do a better job at selecting the vaccine strains and at predicting how useful that vaccine will be as a consequence of this theory.
That gives us a sense that maybe the evolution of the virus is mathematical more than unpredictable. We always think of evolution as taking very unpredictable turns.
Right. So there is certainly a randomness to the evolution. It's very hard to predict what the next strain of the virus will be, but we can predict how many mutations the virus will make, and we can predict what the consequence is of a given number of mutations. One aspect people are interested in is, can you detect new strains of the flu virus? And this is something we can do as well. So we can see new strains of the flu virus emerging this year, and those are likely to be the strains that will then infect people next year. And with that information, that can help then to pick what the strain of the vaccine should be next year.
Do we have a sense of what causes the virus itself to begin to mutate, or is it just sort of a function of its nature? It's constantly mutating because otherwise its host develops immunities and it dies out. It becomes extinct.
Right. So the virus is constantly mutating, and those mutants which allow the virus to escape from the host immune system, those viruses are selected for. More of those viruses are made. So those viruses then might become the ones that will infect more people next year.
Mm. If you, we talk about the other side of the equation, that is how the body fights off influenza. As I understand it, our bodies, because of the foreignness of the nature, recognize certain strains of the influenza virus as an attacker more readily than others, and perhaps makes us more susceptible, and that's one of the reasons for vaccines. Is there some case for that?
Some strains of the virus are more recognizable than others. This happens in another disease called dengue fever. There are four strains, essentially, of dengue fever. And some of them your immune system can recognize more easily than others. And what happens is those strains that your body doesn't recognize as well, you don't develop as effective an immune response against. So it's been quite difficult to develop a vaccine against dengue fever because of this difference in ability to recognize the different strains of dengue fever. So this is something we developed a theory of, and then that theory gave us an idea for how to develop an improved vaccine against dengue fever.
And when, as it relates to flu, I was reading something that said our body recognizes H1N1, which I assume is that a new strain or is that an old strain?
So H1N1 is probably the first documented strain of flu in people. We were infected by H1N1 in 1918. So humans have been infected by H1N1 for a long time. H3N2 first came about in 1968. It's sometimes called the Hong Kong strain. Mm-hmm. And H1N1 was called the Spanish flu, for example. Mm-hmm. So people were very concerned a few years ago when the swine flu scare came about. That wasn't H1N1. People were concerned that maybe this would be like that 1918 epidemic. And we were concerned, I was concerned as well, so we investigated this, and we found that the ability of our immune system to recognize H1N1 is better than our ability to recognize H3N2. So H1N1 vaccines are actually more effective than H3N2 vaccines, and they protect against a broader range of strains. And I would say that probably the reason for this is humans have seen H1N1 for a longer period of time, and our immune system has just been able to adapt to H1N1. So while the Spanish flu was very bad, was a terrible epidemic in 1918.
The pandemic.
If it happened again now, it's unlikely to be as bad because our immune system is actually more effective at recognizing H1N1 than H3N2.
Forgive me if I was thinking that H3N2 was more prevalent in the population in recent years.
It's true. So about two-thirds of the time, humans have been infected by H3N2 since 1968, and about one-third of the time we've been infected by H1N1.
And it seems like if more, you know, that's more prevalent, we would develop immunities quicker. Is there a reason why we haven't? I mean, it's been 40 years now almost.
So it's hard to say, but my guess would be that the reason we have less H1N1 infecting us now is we are already more immune to H1N1. So there's less opportunity for H1N1 to infect us. There's more opportunity for H3N2 to infect us. Probably in the future, some new strain, not H1N1 or H3N2, will become prevalent.
My guest today is Michael Deem. He's a professor of biochemical and genetic engineering, as well as physics and astronomy at Rice University. He'll be delivering the Phi Beta Kappa Visiting Scholar Lecture this afternoon at 4 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the University of Tulsa campus. He'll be speaking on In Search of Fundamental Mathematical Laws of Biology. But as you can hear, a lot of his work is done in vaccine work and also looking at the evolution of bacteria as well as viruses. Now, the early detection of flu strains, have you actually put your theories into practice working with public health at this point, or are you still refining parts of the theory?
So we have had conversations with the World Health Organization, with the Centers for Disease Control, and with BARDA. So these are all aspects of the international and federal government. And, you know, we offer our ability to detect strains to them, and we hope that they'll make more use of this as time goes on.
But right now they're still using animal studies?
Right now they use sequence studies, they use animal studies.
Sequence studies, so explain what that is.
So a sequence study is there are collections of samples of the influenza from people, and then those viruses are sequenced so that the chemical composition of the virus is known. And that chemical composition of the virus tells one something about the strain of the virus and how the immune system will recognize that particular strain of the virus.
Mm. Now, in your mathematical models this year, this has been a pretty bad year for influenza. Did the model pick up the strain that seems to be infecting folks? I know it's a type A flu. I don't know what the strain is, though.
Right. So it's an H3N2 type A flu, influenza A. And we detect that strain as dominant usually either a year or two before it becomes dominant in people. So, yes, we have an ability, and this year was an example, where we can detect the emergence of new strains.
And so it worked well.
It worked well this year, and we've tested this approach over the past 40 years, and it seems to work pretty well. We can always detect the emergence of new strains either 1 year or 2 years before they emerge in the entire human population.
Mm-hmm. How does that compare to sequencing or animal studies? Is there a big variation in between the three results?
Sure. So there have been about 15 or 16 emergence of new strains over the last 40 years, and we can detect 13 or 14 of those fairly well, and that's a couple times more than the current methods used by CDC. So let's say if the CDC could detect it 12 of the years, we can detect it in about 14 of the years.
how are the World Health Organization and public health folks reacting to this research? So I would imagine for life scientists, it's sort of hard to say, well, you know, math, you know, that can't predict this. Is there any resistance?
Well, so the field progresses at a certain pace, and we hope to contribute to that progression.
That's very diplomatic. My guest today, Michael Deem, he'll be delivering the Phi Beta Kappa Visiting Scholars lecture this afternoon at 4 o'clock. Now, one of the other areas of your research has to do about how immune systems respond to attacks. And I know the thing about viruses is they basically take over the system of a cell and basically use that in replicating and infecting a host. You've been studying how bacteria fight off attackers, which are not necessarily viruses. They're something called phages. And you found that it works really quite similar to the adaptive immune system. Tell us a little bit about this.
Right. It's really surprising. It was discovered in about 2007 by people who were trying to grow yogurt that some bacteria, which they were trying to grow in their yogurt, are immune to phages, whereas some other bacteria are not immune to the phages.
Now, what is a phage for those of us?
So a phage is a virus that infects bacteria.
Okay.
And what they found is that these bacteria have an immune system, and the way that immune system works is it incorporates a small section of the genetic material from the phage, and then that bacteria remembers that, and if it sees that same phage later on, it will be immune to that phage. That phage won't be able to infect that bacterium. So this is an adaptive immune system because the bacteria is bringing in new memories from the phages, and it's heritable because the descendants of that bacteria will have copies of that immune system as well.
Was that new and totally unknown to scientists?
This was quite a surprise because people had always assumed that only jawed vertebrates have an adaptive immune system, and wow, even bacteria have an adaptive immune system.
And I understand it's something called CRISPR. What does CRISPR stand for?
So CRISPR stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats, and this is a description of the genetic structure of this immune system.
And as I understand it, this CRISPR system has a really, really long memory.
Yes, so bacteria have CRISPR that have between 20 and 70 spots where they can remember different phages. So this population of bacteria can be immune to a large number of different phages. And this drives then the evolution of the phages, just as our immune system drives the evolution of the influenza virus.
So how can this have a practical application as we see, you know, that even the simplest celled organisms have this adaptive immune system? How can we apply that to humans or to large mammals?
So one practical implication is, for example, a big problem with bacteria is that they develop antibiotic resistance. And one way they develop antibiotic resistance is by incorporating genetic material from other bacteria. So one bacteria might have an enzyme that degrades antibiotics, and that enzyme can be passed to other bacteria by exchange of genetic material. Well, CRISPR inhibits the exchange of genetic material, so it might be possible to put something in CRISPR that would prevent the transfer of these enzymes that degrade antibiotics.
Just as we were talking about harmful bacteria at this point.
Right, so this would be a way that humans might be able to engineer bacteria so they would not become resistant to antibiotics.
That's really exciting research. Where does that stand now? I mean, you just found that this is like 5 years ago. This has got to be in its infancy at this point.
Right. I think this is right now an idea that people have. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On the other side of the coin, the idea of trying to grow beneficial bacteria, say, for example, for yogurt, there the point is you want those bacteria to have this immune system, and you might be able to enhance the power of that immune system by inserting, for example, strains, sequences of phages that you want those bacteria to be immune to.
My guest today is Michael Deem, a professor of biochemical and genetic engineering, as well as physics and astronomy at Rice University, a biochemist who will be delivering the Phi Beta Kappa Visiting Scholars Lecture this afternoon at 4 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium. Well, it sounds like you're doing some really exciting research that can make some really great benefits. What excites you most about what you're researching these days?
So I'm interested in the ability to understand dengue fever. How can we design vaccines against dengue fever using these ideas from mathematics?
For those who are not familiar, and I know dengue fever is a disease of the tropics, but I really have no idea of how serious a disease it is today. Is it still a very, is it?
It's still pretty serious.
Is it like
serious.
Malaria, those numbers, or what exactly?
There are about 50 to 100 million people who are infected with dengue every year, primarily in tropical countries. There are about 2.5 billion people who live in the 100 or so countries in which dengue is endemic. So it's still a pretty serious disease for a big fraction of the world's population.
And does it have a large mortality rate, or is it a low mortality rate, or is it like malaria? I mean, which malaria kills a lot of people, but a lot of people live with it.
Right. So about perhaps a half million to a million people get a severe form of dengue, which is very unpleasant. The mortality is maybe 50 to 100,000. So the mortality rate is hot, not high, but the infection rate and the sort of suffering is reasonably high for this disease.
So give us a sense of what you're working on and what excites you about it.
So I'm working with people who are experts in dengue in terms of trying to design vaccines against the four different serotypes of dengue.
Are there any vaccines out there for dengue at all right now?
There are a few efforts at vaccines, but these vaccines are not effective enough yet. They're not really publicly available. So the short answer is no. We're really still trying to learn enough to be able to design an effective vaccine.
And what are the roadblocks right now in your mind? Or do you feel like you have a good working of how these four serotypes work?
So one of the difficulties is to get the human immune response against all four serotypes. We make a pretty good response against a couple, but not so good a response against the other couple serotypes.
Is that the natural human immunology? Or?
And this is the response against a vaccine against all four serotypes. Mm-hmm. We just don't respond that well to all four. So this is really the current difficulty, to get a nice, uniform, effective response against all four serotypes.
Any success that you can talk about yet?
So there is. So one of the vaccine trials showed a good response against two of the serotypes, but not all four. And we have one of our ideas is to do vaccination in different physical places on the body. And I'll talk a little bit about this in my lecture, how this multi-site vaccination allows your immune system to develop a better response against all four serotypes.
Really? So, arm, buttocks, leg, where exactly?
Sure. Perhaps one in each arm, one in each leg. And then the idea is that that vaccine then will go to some local lymph nodes, which will then select for the T cells that respond well against that particular serotype.
And if you put it all four in one place, would the body sort of be confused, or what would be the reaction?
What seems to happen is if all four serotypes are in one place, then the T cells have a hard time developing against all four. The T cells will only recognize one or two of the serotypes and then grow up against those particular one or two.
And so by moving to each limb, you think that they sort of create a localized response and then it will integrate throughout the whole body on a easier basis.
Right. So by physically separating the different serotypes, the T cells are no longer competing with each other for the access to the different serotypes, and the T cells develop locally against that particular serotype, say, that was injected to that arm. And then after 5 to 10 days, eventually the T cells will then mix throughout your body, and that will develop the systemic immunity against all four serotypes.
Now, is this just a hypothesis? Is it to the point of a trial, or where are we at?
So initially, 5 or 6 years ago, this was a hypothesis, a theory. Since then, there have been a few animal model studies. I don't believe there has yet been a human clinical trial, but that's really the next step.
All right. Well, that sounds like exciting work.
Thank you.
Well, Michael Deem, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us. Professor Michael Deem is a biochemist and physicist at Rice University, a professor of biochemical and genetic engineering and physics and astronomy at that university. He'll be delivering the Phi Beta Kappa Visiting Scholar Lecture this afternoon at 4 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium. That lecture is free and open to the public. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Dr. John Henning Schumann.
Like a lot of preventive health ideas, we have beaten the importance of bike helmets onto everyone's head. Overall, this is probably a good thing. I was lucky in my previous job to be able to walk or ride my bike to work. On the few occasions I failed to wear a helmet, I was castigated by my children, my wife, and even passersby on the street. When you're a doctor, there's higher pressure to practice what you preach. Hey, nobody ever said role modeling is easy. Like seatbelts before them, helmets have become so routine that riding a bike without one makes me feel naked. But what is the cost? We can calculate real and theoretical costs of head injuries due to bike accidents. There are sobering stats. 91% of those killed while biking in 2009 were not wearing helmets, so the danger is real. But what about people choosing not to ride a bike because of mandatory helmet laws? A recent New York Times article compares cities that have bike-sharing programs, where people pay very little or nothing to borrow city-maintained bicycles and use them as a healthy, non-polluting transportation source. Author Elizabeth Rosenthal, anticipating New York City's inauguration of a bike-sharing program, compared cities that required helmets with those that didn't. Perhaps unsurprisingly, cities requiring helmets had much less uptake of bikes than cities that don't. Example: Melbourne, climate, temperate, helmets, required, uptake, 150 rides per day. Dublin, climate, rainy, helmets, not required, uptake, 5,000 rides per day. Editor's conclusion: happiness, Dublin. An expert that Rosenthal interviewed summed up the thinking this way, with some U.S. counterpoint. Quote, "Pushing helmets really kills cycling, and bike sharing in particular, because it promotes a sense of danger that just isn't justified. In fact, cycling has many health benefits," unquote, says Pieta Zhang, a professor in the Department of Applied Finance and Actuarial Studies at Macquarie University in Sydney. He studied the issue with mathematical modeling and concludes that the benefits may outweigh the risks by 20 to 1. He adds, quote, "Statistically, if we wear helmets for cycling, maybe we should wear helmets when we climb ladders or get into a bath, because there are lots more injuries during those activities," end quote. The European Cyclists Federation says that bicyclists in its domain have the same risk of serious injury as pedestrians per mile traveled. Yet the United States National Highway Traffic Safety Administration recommends that, quote, "all cyclists wear helmets no matter where they ride," end quote, said an agency official. There's an ironic but happy ending twist to this story. 3 days after the article ran, former Boston Red Sox manager Bobby Valentine was riding his bike in New York Central Park. He made the unwise choice of reading a text while biking, then flipped over his handlebars, injuring his knees and hips. Said Valentine, per an LA Times story, quote, "I shouldn't have been reading a text while I was riding. That's the wrong thing to do. But at least I was wearing my helmet," end quote. 2 days after that, Red Sox management fired Valentine for leading the team to their worst record in 47 years. Unclear if helmets were involved.
Dr. John Henning Schumann is a physician, our host for Studio Tulsa on Health, and the program director of the Internal Medicine Residency Program at the OU School of Community Medicine. He also writes the blog Glass Hospital. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.